Padula Wilson v. Landry et al., Amanda Wilson, Appellant's Counsel, Christopher Hassel, R. Michael Trumbull, William Mitchell II, Michelle Jesse, Thomas H. Roberts, Tracy Taylor Haig, Dustin M. Paul, W. Thomas Chappell, Julianne C. Miller, Joel M. McRae, Angela Boyce Axel, Appellee's Counsel. Ms. Wilson, were you able to hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Mitchell, were you able to hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Axel, were you able to hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Chief Justice Lemons, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Goodwin, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Mims, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Powell, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Kelsey, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice McCullough, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Chafin, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Mr. Chief Justice, the counsel are here and ready to argue. The appellee's counsel will be sharing time with Mr. Mitchell speaking for 10 minutes and Ms. Axel for 5.
All right. Ms. Padula Wilson, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Mandy Wilson, and I would like 4 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Today, I would ask that you overturn the appellee's demurs and allow my tortious interference of parental rights and defamation claims to go forward. And since the sole reason we are here today is regarding the demur, the sole issue before the court today is whether the facts and reasonable inferences in the 103-page complaint and exhibit state a claim for tortious interference of parental rights and defamation when viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. I say this because throughout many of appellee's briefs, they attempted to add their version of events, which, of course, as we all know, are inappropriate for demur. The trial court did not take evidence, and so the facts in the complaint are considered true for the purposes of the demur. And the court explicitly stated that he was not going to go outside the pleadings at appendix page 160. For your reference, all of the court's rulings regarding the tortious interference of parental rights claim are on appendix page 261 to 265, and this did form the basis for assignment of error 1. The trial court's primary reason for granting the demurs was his belief that these torts should not be allowed after or involving a custody case. Specifically, the trial court said, and this is a quote, "This is just going to cause a continuous round of litigation after custody cases. As we know now, when you start out in the JMDR court, you go to a circuit court, you go to a court of appeals, you go to the Supreme Court. Enough is enough. This actually creates almost like a habeas proceeding for custody cases where we later can come back from another angle." And that was the end of his quote. But in doing so, when the court made that ruling, what he actually did is he overruled Wyatt versus Dermott, which is the seminal tortious interference with parental rights case in this court. And that was, in that case, that involved a custody case. His court ruling there was at appendix page 261. First off, regarding the court's ruling, we already have the judicial doctrine of res judicata, which prevents anyone in Virginia from coming back at a case from another angle. That is not what is happening here. The same parties that were involved in the custody case are not involved here, and as Wyatt versus McDermott explicitly states, tortious interference of parental rights can never be used to recover a child. Unfortunately, the trial court's ruling leaves a right without a remedy, provides no accountability for those who wrongfully interfere with someone's custodial rights, maliciously or in bad faith, and thus provides no incentives for those who commit wrongs to correct their actions. Today, we have an opportunity to disincentivize bad behavior in or after custody cases by those who would wrongfully take a child away from their parent, by making up completely false accusations about a parent, by breaking a court order, or by even enticing someone else to break a custody court order. This court has already alleviated the trial court's concerns that there would be an endless round of tortious interference with parental rights cases after custody cases by requiring in Coward versus Wellmont that all conduct and harm in such cases must be egregious. Frankly, this is genius because it provides a perfect balancing act which eliminates most torts after custody cases to keep us from opening a can of worms we don't need to open, while still allowing those who have been harmed the most to bring the tort. In this case, the conduct and harm is egregious when Nelson, Campanella, and Wirt broke the June 20, 2014 final custody court order, which entitled mother to visitation, and refused to allow any contact with one child, which lasted 3 years, and two other children over a period of months. The conduct and harm is egregious when Landry and Gasper conspired outside of court to falsely call mother totally delusional and psychotic when they knew it was false because they were mad they were put on a website. And this did cause mother to lose all contact with her children for 8 months. As stated in Wyatt versus McDermott, and this is a quote, tortious interference with parental or custodial relationship intimates that the complaining parent has been deprived of his or her parental or custodial rights. In other words, but for the tortious interference, the complaining parent would have been able to exercise some measure of control over his child's care, rearing, safety, well-being, etc. Well, from that quote in Wyatt versus McDermott, I would propose that a test based on a custody case for egregious harm is that the defendant prevented a parent from exercising some measure of control over the child's care, rearing, safety, and well-being by wrongfully causing the parent to either have supervised visitation or no contact. This test would eliminate most cases from being brought from custody cases while still allowing those who have suffered the most to bring suit. Next, I want to talk a little bit about causation, because this is what the trial court says about causation, and this is the court's ruling on appendix page 263, and this is a quote, and the judge made the decision in this case, not the people involved in this case. There was just a period of time in there when a judge, you know, as is often in custody cases that are pending, but perhaps not in a final order, left some visitation up to an expert. The expert made a decision, but again, I don't see the causal relationship here, end quote. So basically what the trial court is saying is, yeah, I get it. These people were making the decisions, but I still don't see how they caused it, even though they were making the decisions to withhold the child. Proximate cause, as we all know, is an act or admission in natural and continuing sequence unbroken by a superseding cause, which produces a particular event and without which that event would not have occurred. As we also all know, proximate cause is a question for the jury. It's clear here when Landry and Gasper conspired outside of court to falsely call mother delusional and psychotic that it was designed to and did produce in a natural and continuing sequence the wrongful loss of children, without which that event would not have occurred. And this is stated explicitly in the complaint at paragraph 64, that's appendix page 19 and 20. Additionally, proximate cause existed when Nelson, Campanella, and Work broke the June 20th, 2014 final custody court order in order to withhold the children contrary to the order, and that breaking of the custody court order by Nelson, Campanella, and Work was designed to and did produce in natural and continuous sequence the wrongful loss of children without which that event would not have occurred. And this is alleged in the complaint starting at paragraph 99, goes through paragraph 114, and includes exhibit L. The trial court nonetheless seems to intimate that he believes that the custody court is the cause and not the defendants themselves. Let me tell you why the custody court did not cause this, but the defendants did. When the Nelson, Campanella, and Wirt were breaking the custody court's June 20th, 2014 final court order, the trial court didn't even have jurisdiction, and so it could not have been the cause. Further, common sense dictates the court could never be the cause of Nelson, Wirt, and Campanella disobeying the court by breaking its order. As far as Landry and Gasper, What Justice Powell and Justice Lemon state in their respective opinions in Dorman versus State Industries and Williams versus Lee is key here, and this is a quote from Justice Powell's opinion, quote, "We have also recognized that an intervening cause is not a superseding cause if it was put into operation by the defendant's wrongful act or omission." In Justice Lemon's opinion, his quote is, quote, "An intervening cause does not operate to exempt a defendant from liability if that cause is put into operation by the defendant's wrongful act or omission," end quote. So when Landry and Gasper are conspiring outside of court to falsely call Mother delusional and psychotic, when they knew it was false in order to wrongfully take her children because they were mad they were put on a website, then they cannot blame the court as a superseding or intervening cause when that court order was put into operation by Landry and Gasper's wrongful act of conspiring outside of court to falsely call Mother delusional and psychotic. Therefore, the custody court didn't cause this. The defendant did. The custody court was an innocent victim of the defendant's deception. And this right here is why, in our seminal tortious interference of parental rights case, Wyatt versus McDermott, the attorneys, the adoption agency, the grandparents, they were also liable for tortious interference of parental rights, even though it was a court that ultimately took Wyatt's child from him. Because but for the defendant's wrongful act, that court would have never taken Wyatt's child, which is exactly what happened in this case. With the additional time I have remaining before my rebuttal time starts, I want to quickly cover judicial privilege, which was an additional basis for the court granting appellee's demur.
You're down to 4:45. Use your time well.
Okay. I just want to say this court, I recognize that a judicial privilege is an affirmative defense and so not normally appropriate for demur, which only tests the facial validity of the allegations in a complaint rather than the validity of the affirmative defenses. But this court has, in Baker versus Butterworth, has decided an affirmative defense previously regarding a demur. And so I would suggest that the defendants did not meet their burden for judicial privilege based on the allegations in the complaint. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. We'll give you that for your 3:56. You asked for 4. We'll just give you the 4. How about that?
Oh, thank you very much.
All right. Now, I understand that there's a split of the time of 15 minutes. Mr. Mitchell, you have 10. Ms. Axel, you have 5. Tell me which one of the two of you goes first.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. This is Mr. Mitchell. I will be going first.
All right, Mr. Mitchell. 10 minutes.
May it please the court. In Wyatt versus McDermott, this court recognized the tort of intentional interference with parental rights. In Coward versus Wellmont, a couple of years ago, the court defined important limits of this theory of tort liability. The current case presents yet another opportunity for the court to clarify further the limits of this theory of tort liability. What I would refer the court to is what, when you synthesize Wyatt and Coward, the jurisprudence in this jurisdiction to this point, you end up with essentially three pillars that are the foundation for this cause of action. It's a common law claim. Egregious conduct, absence of consent, and lack of due process protections. And in this particular case, decided on demur, based on the allegations and a very lengthy complaint, none of those pillars are present. The current case presents a situation where my client, who was the court-appointed guardian ad litem for the minor children in an ongoing custody and visitation proceeding, and the other appellees who were various mental health, child psychologist type professionals who were either appointed by the court or privately retained to provide services in those proceedings, whether they can have civil liability that's ultimately for decisions made by the court in those proceedings. And this case, unlike Wyatt, unlike Coward, implicates special duties of these professionals, the guardian, the mental health therapists and professionals, and their somewhat unique standing in custody and visitation proceedings. Coward dealt in large measure with the issue of absence of consent. And in that case, you had an adoption-type situation where the biological mother and father agreed, consented to the adoption of a newborn, and then after a couple of weeks, the mother changed her mind after papers had been signed and the process had gone in motion. Well, here we've got a situation where my client was retained by the court, appointed by the court, to act on behalf of the minor children involved in this dispute. So, obviously, at some point during the process, one or both of the parents are not going to agree or consent to the recommendations and the positions that the guardian takes. That's why this case would represent a rather breathtaking expansion of the tort as it's been enunciated and defined in Wyatt and Coward if it were allowed to proceed, as the appellant wishes it to. In just about every case, these recommendations and conclusions concerning the child's best interest regarding custody, visitation, changes of those concepts are going to be undertaken with the knowledge that one or both parents is not going to consent. They're not going to like it. The other experts in this case, whether retained privately or court-appointed, stand in similar shoes. They're charged with making evaluations and giving reports, giving testimony, presenting evidence regarding what their professional judgment says. And if they're allowed to be held civilly liable based on that under a claim of tortious interference with parental rights, again, you've got a situation where the proverbial floodgates would open. Additionally, in this case, there's the issue of the taking. The minor children were not taken in the concept or context that was enunciated in Wyatt or Coward. In Wyatt, that was an adoption that occurred where the biological father was kept in the dark, had no idea, had fully intended to raise this child with the biological mother. The mother and the mother's parents and some others conspired and basically, you know, said, you know, we're going to keep this a secret. And they secreted the child off for an adoption in another state. The child was not even in the Commonwealth. There were no ongoing proceedings. In this particular case, I think if you look at Wyatt, one of the court's major concerns, in addition to the sufficiently egregious conduct, in addition to the lack of consent, was quite frankly the absence of any protections. In this particular case, the complaint goes on and on and on in allegations about how the appellant had the full panoply of rights. She had due process. She had a proceeding in which she was allowed to cross-examine witnesses. She was allowed to present her own evidence. She did so. She had the right of appeal. These were pendente lite orders, which were subject to modification by the court. She filed successive motions. There were hearings. There were orders. That's all delineated in the pleading. So the third pillar, ample due process concerns. This is not a situation where someone grabs up a child and literally or figuratively kidnaps them or abducts them or convinces somebody else to take the child and secrete them so that they're away from the custodial parent for a very, very long time, if not forever. That's what they were talking about in Wyatt, where there was no remedy. And I would point out that with professionals, particularly guardians ad litem, there are remedies within the judicial process. There's contempt. Guardians are lawyers. There are professional obligations, ethical obligations. There are many, many, many remedies that exist in this particular factual circumstance that did not exist in Wyatt, and which was in part what compelled the court's need to recognize the tort under those circumstances. Your Honors, I'd like to take, my timer says I've got a little less than 4 minutes. I'd like to touch briefly on the issue of the judicial privilege. Now, taking the appellant's last point about it being an affirmative defense and not typically decided on demur, that's not entirely accurate. I have firsthand experience with this particular issue. Mansfield versus Burnaby, decided 8 years ago, was decided by the lower court on demur, and it dealt with the absolute privilege. And there are other cases that the court I know is aware of where the privilege has been dealt with in the context of a demur. Here, there's no question based on the pleadings, there was an ongoing judicial proceeding. The child custody and visitation case was ongoing when all of these acts allegedly occurred. All of the things that are alleged, malicious, bad faith, all the things that have been, the characterization that's been ascribed to them by the appellant, all occurred within the context of and were pertinent to the ongoing judicial proceeding. Under the law in the Commonwealth, if a communication or action is relevant to or pertinent to an ongoing judicial proceeding, you know, obviously the proceeding doesn't end at the courthouse door. It doesn't end in the courtroom door. It extends. It's quite broad. It would cover a claim for tortious interference. The court is aware of its own jurisprudence in the regular tortious interference with contract situation where it has recognized that privilege, if applicable, would bar that claim. And that's the court noted that in the Lockheed case from a few years ago. So you've got a situation here where people have, based on the allegations in the complaint, have undertaken actions as part of their job and their duties with respect to an ongoing custody and visitation case. You've got a situation where what's being complained of is the result of information that they provided in the context of that proceeding. The appellant claims that there was false testimony. The appellant claims that there was extrinsic fraud. There's a bunch of characterizations and allegations in this lengthy complaint. But as to privilege, it doesn't matter because the privilege is absolute, and it would cover those things. And it covers all of the appellees in this particular situation. Your Honor, I see that I have a minute and a half, so I just want to recapitulate on what I've been assigned to deal with. The Circuit Court correctly concluded that tort liability for intentional interference with parental rights does not extend to actions, communications, or conduct of guardians ad litem and adverse mental health professionals and therapists in these types of proceedings, child custody and visitation. The appellant was not permanently deprived of custody or the maintenance of a parental relationship with their minor children. The children were not abducted. They were not enticed to leave the appellant's custody. The trial court entered a series of temporary and modifiable custody and visitation orders after judicial proceedings with procedural safeguards that were not available in Wyatt. Tort liability for intentional interference with parental rights addresses extrajudicial situations that is not available under these circumstances. This tort cannot and should not be used as a weapon to expand and prolong custody and visitation disputes by parties that are disappointed in the outcome of those proceedings. The court should affirm the trial court's decision sustaining the appellee's demurs. And unless the court has any questions for me, I would defer the rest of the appellee's time to my colleague.
Well, that's not how it works when you represent different parties. She has 5 minutes, Ms. Axel. You have 5 minutes, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I represent two of the defendants, Michelle Nelson and her practice, Forensic Psychology Associates. And I wanted to address the remaining assignment error there of defamation because that is my client is the only one that still is the target of that assignment of error. Your Honor, I wanted to point out that Dr. Nelson's role in this case was as a psychologist. She prepared two court-ordered evaluations, which haven't been challenged. The part that's been challenged of her involvement are visitation decisions that she made on behalf of the court between June 2014 and December 2015. As a part of awarding sole custody to the father, the court also instructed Dr. Nelson, the psychologist, to make visitation decisions on behalf of the court, and it entered an order to that effect. And she did so until the court entered a subsequent order in December, relieving her of that obligation. This actually, these visitation decisions are the factual, if you will, basis for all the claims against Dr. Nelson. So with respect to defamation, Ms. Wilson cites 5 emails that she claims Dr. Nelson sent over a 4-month time period. She was making those visitation decisions over the course of 18 months. But she cites 4 months of defamation decisions. And it's clear from looking at the language that these emails and the excerpts from these emails are not defamation. These are her concerns, her understanding of circumstances, her interpretation of what was going on, and her opinions. regarding visitation at the time. The court determined that these communications were privileged based on the cases of Briscoe versus Lafue and Watt v. McKelvey. And we support that decision, obviously. I would point out for the court that the decisions that she made regarding visitation during this time period were truly under the direction and authority of the custody court based on a court order ordering her to do so. And therefore, they fall under that privilege of an integral part of a judicial process, as stated in the Briscoe case. In addition, Ms. Wilson, during her argument, acknowledged that Dr. Nelson was permitted to make the visitation decisions and was even required to do so by the court. One other thing I will point out for the court, it's mentioned in the brief from Ms. Wilson that she appealed the court's decision to award custody to the father and grant and instruct Dr. Nelson to make visitation decisions. And her argument in that case went up to the Court of Appeals. Her position in that case was that the court had abdicated its judicial authority to Dr. Nelson. So she's acknowledged in that case that that's what the court was doing, was giving her sort of a pseudo-judicial authority to make those decisions. And that's on page 46 of her brief. For those reasons, we agree that the privilege does still apply to those communications. In addition, the court didn't get into the details, sort of the elements of a defamation claim, didn't go that far, but we would argue for this purposes of this appeal that had the court done so, the court would have found that the elements of a defamation claim couldn't have been met either, and that the allegation that there's an actionable statement with a requisite intent, that there was harm to her reputation, that they were factually false, and that they weren't opinions. If you read the emails that are cited in the brief, those five emails, they clearly were emails that were not intended to be false, but were her impressions and her concerns and her understanding of the circumstances, and then followed up with her professional opinion regarding visitation. And there was no, clearly, even on its surface, no intent to defame Ms. Wilson. For these reasons, we ask that the court, we agree with all the arguments presented by Mr. Mitchell, and we ask that the court affirm the trial court's decision to deny all claims against all parties. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much. Ms. Wilson, do you go by Padula Wilson or just Wilson?
Just Wilson, Your Honor.
All right. Ms. Wilson, you have 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First off, I want to address Mr. Mitchell's argument that all of the orders were temporary. The orders were temporary until June 20th, 2014. That was actually a final custody court order. And as Ms. Axel acknowledges, in that final custody court order, the judge did abdicate his judicial duties. He, first of all, set in that order, as alleged in the complaint, that mother was entitled to certain visitation at a minimum, but that Dr. Nelson and Campanella were to set the schedule, as alleged in the complaint. That was a final order. That order was ultimately appealed to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals did overturn that order, and it ultimately went back to the custody court. So anything after June 20th, 2014, when Nelson, Campanella, and Wirt were breaking the court order, which entitled mother to visitation, and instead actually withheld the children, two of them for months at a time, and one child, who's now 20, for up to 3 years. When they were breaking that order, then they were acting outside of the court. First of all, the court didn't have the authority to give that authority to them, but what the court did dictate, that mother would have certain visitation, they broke that court order. So it could not have been in the course of a judicial proceeding, obviously, since the court didn't even have jurisdiction, as that case at that time was at the Court of Appeals. And then ultimately this court, when the this court rejected the petition in August 12th, I believe, of 2015. So those would have been outside of any type of judicial proceedings. Also, anything that occurred outside of court, everything that was done, it was made very clear in the trial court in the complaint, everything that's sued for is done outside of court. Nothing that happens inside the court doors is being sued for. It's the out-of-court conspiracies to make up these false allegations that are being sued for. So those are clearly outside of any type of judicial proceedings, simply because there's just no judicial safeguards. I went through the case law extensively in the brief regarding this, but there has to be judicial safeguards in order for there to be judicial proceedings, obviously, and those things can't happen when people are on their emails or their phones making these types of false allegations up. So there was no due process because the court didn't have the authority to abdicate its duty to determine custody and visitation. There was, you know, of those sorts of things, and there was not even a court case going on at the time because the case was on appeal when Nelson Wirt and Campanella were breaking this court order. Further, when the defamation was happening, the allegations of defamation all occurred between April 2015 and August 2015, which is when the custody case was actually in the Supreme Court. And so there was absolutely, of course, no judicial proceeding whatsoever. And the fact
Ms.
that
Wilson, you have 30 seconds remaining, so be sure and wrap up.
Okay, thank you very much, Your Honor, for letting me know. The opinion regarding the defamation, the court didn't rule that they were opinions. It simply ruled based on qualified privilege. So the court never made the ruling that they weren't opinions or they weren't. But if they're couched in opinions, if they are verifiable or non-verifiable facts, that's the case. And these facts are all verifiable. So they are not opinions. I would ask that you would allow the tortious interference and defamation claims to go forward, and I greatly, greatly, greatly appreciate you taking the case and allowing me to present. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel, for your arguments. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.